headlines, Russia's President Putin condemns NATO's imperial ambitions and pledges to respond in kind to the deployment of military infrastructure in Finland and Sweden. Plus, the Israeli Knesset is voting on its dissolution, setting the stage for an early election in November, the fifth one in 3 years. And indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. for the removal of sanctions end in Doha, but Iran says it will continue contacts with the EU coordinator. Hello and welcome, everybody. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow would respond if NATO deployed troops and infrastructure in Finland and Sweden after they join the alliance.
We don't have problems with Finland and Sweden that unfortunately we have with Ukraine. We have no territorial disputes with them. There is nothing that might concern us in terms of Finland and Sweden becoming NATO members. If they want to, please go ahead. But they should clearly understand that they didn't face any threats before this. Now, if NATO troops and infrastructure are deployed, we will be compelled to respond in kind and create the same threats for the territories from which threats toward us are created. This is obvious.
Putin was talking to reporters in a news conference in Turkmenistan's capital city of Ashgabat. He said it was inevitable that Moscow's relations with Helsinki and Stockholm would sour after they joined the U.S.-led military alliance. Putin also condemned what he called NATO's imperial ambitions. He accused the alliance of seeking to assert its supremacy through the Ukraine conflict. Putin said NATO does not care for the well-being of the Ukrainian people and only means to defend its own interests. He added that the objective of Moscow's special military operation in Ukraine remains unchanged. Putin said the ultimate goal of Moscow's operation is liberating Ukraine's eastern Donbass region and ensuring Russia's security. Now, sir, it's the 25th anniversary of Hong Kong's return to mainland China, and President Xi Jinping is paying a visit to the territory on this occasion. This is Xi's first trip outside mainland China since the beginning of the pandemic. A delegation of high-ranking officials is also accompanying him. President Xi is expected to attend the swearing-in ceremony of the city's incoming leader, John Lee, tomorrow. The media have not reported much detail about the trip, but he's expected to have meetings with a group of pro-Beijing politicians. Strict COVID considerations are in place during the visit. Well, just minutes ago, Israeli lawmakers voted on the dissolution of the Knesset, a development that marks the end of Naftali Bennett's tenure as prime minister. The dispersal of the parliament will fuel continued political instability in Israel, pushing the regime towards its fifth election in just over 3 years. The lawmakers have also voted to hold the elections on November the 1st. Last week, Bennett moved to dissolve the Knesset after his ruling coalition collapsed following a series of defections. The prime minister says he will not run in the upcoming elections. His predecessor, Benjamin Netanyahu, has called Bennett's administration the worst in Israel's history. Netanyahu is planning a comeback by winning a sixth term in office, even though he's on trial for a number of corruption charges. In other news, indirect talks between Iran and the United States for the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA have come to an end in the Qatari capital, Doha. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, says Tehran offered its practical ideas and proposals on the outstanding issues during the Doha talks. He added that the opposite side also presented its considerations. Kanani said Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagheri-Kani, will be in touch with the European Union's JCPOA coordinator, Enrique Mora. The Doha negotiations were held as an extension of previous talks held in the Austrian capital. The Vienna talks were stalled in March over what Tehran called Washington's excessive demands. The 2015 deal was left in tatters after Washington unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Well, Iran has marked the National Day of Fight Against Chemical and Biological Weapons. The occasion is to commemorate the victims of the Sardash chemical attacks launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in June 1987. Salman Kujuri has more.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western government's inhumane policies when Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the 8-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belonged to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged the international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Philippines has a new president. About an hour ago, freshly elected Ferdinand Marcos Jr. took his oath of office in a public ceremony. Marcos Jr., son of the country's late ruler, was sworn in before hundreds of local and foreign dignitaries, as well as journalists and supporters in Manila. In his inauguration speech that echoed his campaign slogans of unity, the new president pledged serious reforms in education and energy sectors. He also promised to improve food sufficiency. Marcos scored a landslide victory over outgoing President Rodrigo Duterte in last month's elections. His inauguration takes place as rising prices are squeezing the country's economy. Widespread starvation looms large as the United Nations slashes its funding for war-ravaged Yemen. We discuss the matter with the analysts on our news review program. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Widespread starvation is looming on the horizon as the UN has slashed its funding for the war-ravaged Yemen. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says that over 19 million people are going hungry in Yemen. The figure is the highest since the start of the Saudi-led war in the impoverished country. According to the UN Children's Agency, about 2.3 million children also suffer from acute malnutrition, as Yemenis are scrambling to get enough food due to 8 years of Saudi-led war and famine. Riyadh's military action has pushed Yemen into what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The World Food Program currently provides food aid to 13 million Yemenis, but the agency has announced drastic cuts, meaning only 5 million of them will be able to access the assistance. Let's break this down a little bit. First, we bring in Yusuf Mauri, who's a Yemeni journalist and political analyst who joins us from Sana'a. We also have Lawrence Davidson, a former lecturer at Westchester University, who joins us from Westchester, PA. Welcome to you both. Yusuf Mauri, I'll first start with you. So there are some promising signs still when you take a look at the dialogue that's taking place, if there is one, even though one side is breaking the terms of the truce. This is a short-term truce. Do you see any hope in that prevailing and becoming successful? At this point, we're talking about a little bit of time that has passed since the announcement.
It's hard to be optimistic about the ceasefire agreement when there's continuous violations of the ceasefire agreement, right? You have constant reports of shelling taking place from the Saudi side into Yemeni soil. You have reports of Saudi drones launching espionage missions over the skies of Sana'a, over the skies of Sa'da, over the skies of various provinces throughout Yemen. In some instances, there has been even a number of airstrikes on Yemeni soil. So it's very hard to be optimistic on whether there's going to be a lasting ceasefire agreement. I doubt that the ceasefire is going to last much longer if these violations continue to happen. And the Ansar Allah leadership has announced that, you know, they're going to continue to call on the UN and the international community to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for its continuous violations of the ceasefire agreement. However, as expected, the UN and the international community seems to be supporting the Saudi coalition, and they continue to support the Saudi war on Yemen directly or indirectly. There's no condemnation at all taking place against Saudi Arabia for its violations, right? And on the other hand, you have the international community led by the UN, led by the US, condemning the Sana'a government for, protecting its land, protecting its soil, and trying to revive its economy. Although that's been very, very difficult to do when there's a blockade, a strangling blockade being imposed on the country, right? And that's when you have the UN stepping in to make these statements that there's all these starving people in Yemen, you know, child malnutrition is increasing. And, you know, basically the UN is saying, is calling out for its donors to give them money. It saddens me to say this, but the UN is actually, has been involved in one of the biggest scams in history. And that scam is dependent on people dying and people starving to death so that it can be converted into money, currency for the UN, in order for the UN to continue supporting geopolitical policies by the against Yemen, to continue supporting the policies by Saudi Arabia to directly starve the entire country.
This is really, I mean, it's really sad when you take a look, obviously, at the horrific pictures. And it's sadder to say that we're getting used to seeing that over the past years that this has happened. But at the same time, when you see money flowing in and helping Ukraine by the minute from the U.S. And its allies, these people need to get some relief, and they're not.
Right. I mean, hypocrisy is the name of the game here. It's clear that great powers, like the United States and country, subsidiary of the U.S., do not care about the starvation of folks in Yemen, the use of Gaza as an experimental munitions range. I mean, they don't care about that. And the reason they don't care about that is that their relationships with one side of these conflicts are more important. So for the United States, the relationship with Israel, and this has to do with the power equilibrium within Washington, the relationship with Israel is more important than the people in Gaza. And the relationship with Saudi Arabia is more important than the people in Yemen. Now, you might be able to affect that somewhat by large numbers of demonstrators appearing in the streets of London or subsidiary cities in England. Nobody's gathering and protesting the situation in Yemen. No one is in the United States is protesting and demanding that Biden, talk about Yemen when he's in Saudi Arabia, or talk about Gaza or the assassination of Palestinian press people when he's in Israel. Nobody's demanding that. And so if nobody is demanding that, then the standard relationships go on.
Thank you for that. Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer at Westchester University. Thank you, Yusuf Nari. It's good to see you again. Yemeni journalist and political analyst who spoke to us from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Elsewhere, a vigil in the U.S. city of San Antonio in Texas honors scores of migrants who were found dead in a tractor trailer earlier this week. The victims were from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. So far, the death toll from the tragedy stands at 53, with over a dozen migrants still in hospital. Those attending the vigil blame the U.S. immigration system for the incident.
We have a broken system of immigration, and people are forced to make very tragic decisions. And this is unacceptable. We need to come together. We need to stand together and demand action. This is a call to action.
I don't care if I'm American or if I'm Mexican. I'm human. I feel. I speak. I cry. I'm angry. Are y'all angry?
Yeah.
Are y'all angry?
The tractor trailer was discovered abandoned 3 days ago in a desolate industrial area on the outskirts of San Antonio. The area is located near the U.S.-Mexico border. The suspected driver of the truck and an accused conspirator have already been charged in a U.S. federal court with human trafficking offenses. If convicted, each man faces a maximum sentence of life in prison or possibly the death penalty. South Texas has long been the busiest area for illegal border crossings. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
An investigation said recently by funding and stocking products from Brazilian meat giant JBS, global financiers and UK supermarkets have supported land grabbing and deforestation. Here, we present you an article in this regard written by Sophie Kevani under the heading Banks and UK supermarkets charged with backing deforestation in Brazil. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. An investigation said recently global financiers, UK supermarkets, and an Italian leather supplier have supported deforestation, land grabbing, and the use of slave labor in Brazil by funding and stocking products from the Brazilian meat giant JBS. Financial institutions mentioned in the investigation's report were HSBC, Barclays, Santander, Deutsche Bank, BlackRock, and JP Morgan. The report said the institutions had for years funneled billions of dollars to JBS and continue to do so, while at the same time pledging to remove deforestation from their portfolios. The report noted that Barclays facilitated a bond deal for JBS worth almost $1 billion last year and said the bank has continually done business with JBS over multiple years despite numerous global witness reports on the company. The report further found that between September and October of last year, investment companies controlled by Deutsche Bank, HSBC, Santander, BlackRock, and JP Morgan held shares worth more than $293 million in JBS. The supermarket selling products that used JBS beef, which were checked in February this year, were named as Sainsbury's, Iceland, and Esta. The report named the Italian leather supplier Group Masterotto as a buyer of JBS skins. Global Witness, which conducted the investigation, said its findings came as deforestation reaches record levels and while the dismantling of environmental policies and weakening of environmental agencies under Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro have been highlighted as key risks that may push the Amazon to an irreversible tipping point with devastating consequences for indigenous peoples and local communities, the global climate and biodiversity. The investigation highlighted two different types of JBS supply chain issue, direct and indirect. In the direct supply chain, the report found JBS sourcing cattle from 144 ranches in the Amazon state of Pará that contained over 10,000 football pitches of illegal Amazon clearance, contrary to its legal no deforestation obligations. The report said that in the indirect supply chain, JBS had failed to monitor a further 1,600 reaches, which it said were linked to 57,000 football pitches worth of both legal and illegal deforestation. Responding to the charges in the report, Global Witness said JBS denied the claim that all the 144 direct supply ranches were non-compliant with its no deforestation policy. In a statement to The Guardian, JBS said it had blocked one of the direct suppliers in Pará as soon as we received the NGO allegations of further fraudulent activity. The statement went on to claim JBS had a zero-tolerance policy for illegal deforestation, land grabbing, slave labor, or human rights abuses associated with our supply chains. JBS said it respected its own responsible procurement, an NGO and a state-agreed due diligence monitoring protocols at all times, and had used the best available official data to assess all potential suppliers across an area three times larger than the UK daily for the past 10 years and immediately blocks any non-compliant farms. JBS has committed to monitor its entire supply chain by 2025, including problematic indirect suppliers, but says that despite its request, the Brazilian government under Bolsonaro has not made available some of the records which are necessary. In collaboration with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and Reporter Brazil, The Guardian previously exposed links to illegal deforestation in the JBS supply chains. The company went on to reorganize and to remake a pledge to reach net zero emissions by 2040. responding to the report's claims that it stocked JBS beef products. A Sainsbury's spokesperson said the link between cattle farming and the destruction of ecosystems like the Amazon, the Cerrado, and the Pantanal is a complex issue which we take extremely seriously. It added that despite efforts to address the problems, not enough progress has been made, and as a result, we no longer offer fresh own brand corned beef products from Brazil. We have also committed to stop sourcing any own brand corned beef from Brazil so that we can ensure our product does not contribute to deforestation. Asta said in an email that it does not source any of its products from the supplier named in this investigation. The link in the report between Asta and JBS was made on the basis of Asta's stocking Exeter corned beef. Asta claimed in an email to The Guardian that it no longer stocked Exeter products. A Santander spokesperson told The Guardian it is committed to protecting the Amazon and operates strict policies which govern our financing activity in the region. It claimed that it expected beef processing clients in the Amazon to have a fully traceable supply chain that is deforestation-free by 2025, including indirect suppliers of cattle as a prerequisite for granting credit. We believe this is the most ambitious lending standard of any bank in the region. A Deutsche Bank spokesperson claimed that it did not knowingly finance activities that result in the clearing of primary forest, involve illegal logging or conversion of high conservation value, high carbon stocks, forest, or peatlands. Where we work with conglomerates, we make a significant effort to ensure our financing is only directed to activities that are in line with our policies. HSBC referred The Guardian to its response in the report, which said its asset management business held shares in the beef giant on behalf of others and that it had no influence over the decision to invest in JBS. BlackRock similarly pointed The Guardian to its responses in the report, which claimed it had engaged with the company to seek improved compliance with its commitments, and that its voting record at JBS annual shareholders meeting showed it objected to the company's poor oversight of risk management processes, including on its sustainability performance. JP Morgan told The Guardian that it declined to comment on the charges. Barclays declined to comment to The Guardian, but told Global Witness that it was committed to purportedly helping its corporate clients achieve zero net deforestation. Group MassRoto told Global Witness that while it admitted purchasing from JBS Tannery in Para, the purchase volumes were small and that it had since stopped buying from JBS. Iceland, meanwhile, claimed that it engaged with its suppliers to ensure they sourced their beef responsibility.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We'll be right back.
It's called the New Force Model by NATO, in which it says it is a new strategic concept, one that describes Russia as the most significant and direct threat to allies' security and stability. Now we ask, what is so new about that? Meanwhile, Russia has reacted and has accused the U.S.-led NATO of aggressive containment of Russia. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll review the NATO summit's communique, which also includes how it has described China of being a threat to the world order.
Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization gathered for their annual summit in the Spanish capital, Madrid. As expected, this year's summit turned into an anti-Russia agenda in the wake of growing tensions between Moscow and the West over the Ukraine war that began in February.
President Putin's war against Ukraine has shattered peace in Europe and has created the biggest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War.
The Western Military Alliance also pledged to ramp up military support for Ukraine.
And today, leaders agreed to strengthen our support by agreeing a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. This includes equipment to counter mines and chemical and biological threats, and hundreds of portable anti-drone systems.
Western countries, including the United States, have provided Kyiv with billions of dollars worth of weapons since the war began. Russia sees it as the main factor behind prolonging the conflict.
It seems to us that the kind of line that the West has taken is absolutely counterproductive and harmful. The more they pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this conflict will last.
Irrespective of huge military support for Ukraine, NATO's ambitious plan for expanding its membership has also driven a wedge between the alliance and Russia. However, NATO leaders have welcomed Finland and Sweden into the alliance after Turkey struck a deal with the Nordic duo to drop its objections.
Today, NATO leaders took the historic decision to invite Finland and Sweden to become members of NATO. The agreement concluded last night by Turkey, Finland and Sweden paved the way for this decision.
Russia says the two countries' accession to NATO is destabilizing.
We consider the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to be a purely destabilizing factor in international affairs. It does not add security either to those who are expanding it, those joining it, or to other countries that perceive the alliance as a threat.
The rift between Russia and the West has raised concerns that the ongoing war in Ukraine could escalate into a nuclear conflict, the fallout of which could deal devastating blows to the world.
Our guests joining us for this edition of the Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik, an international human rights and labor lawyer, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Kent Stone, from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who joins us from Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ken Sonnen, we'll first start with you. What do you think about the name New Force Model, which NATO describes as a new strategic blueprint in which the U.S.-led NATO is referring to Russia based on this as a direct threat to the security of the member states? And then my question to you is, what is so new about this? And even if it's true, who provoked this sentiment for Russia to become, as they perceive, a security threat?
Well, it's not new at all. As a matter of fact, when
Lester B. Pearson, who was Foreign Minister of Canada, proposed the formation of NATO before 1949. His view was to bring down socialism in the former Soviet Union and to actually bring down the Soviet Union. So NATO has been a threat, an existential threat to Russia for 70 years. And once the Soviet Union dissolved itself, rather than dissolving NATO, which was supposed to be dealing with a supposed Russian threat, NATO went on the warpath and showed its true colors. It is the aggressive military alliance led by the United States, which promptly in the 1990s went against the former Yugoslavian Federation. It attacked it, bombed it for 78 days, and destroyed it, and swallowed up its component parts. Then it went after Afghanistan, and then it went after Iraq, and then it went after Libya. So the U.S. Has NATO in its pocket as an aggressive military alliance. The U.S., when the Soviet Union dissolved itself, wanted to become the only superpower in a unipolar world, and that's what they're trying to do today in Madrid. They are saying that Russia is the enemy, and Russia does not want to be seen as its enemy.
Okay.
Okay.
You make some good points there. I'd like to, however, move on to this timeline, Daniel Kovalik, which was highlighted just a few weeks back, and that is the fact that this war passed 100 days. And that was obviously a very grim milestone in a sense. But in reality, this war has been going on now for 8 years, hasn't it? And if you want to even go further than that, we can, because Russia has been seeing NATO's eastward expansion for all this time, hasn't it? It's been provoked, whether directly by NATO and its moves, but even more so maybe by the U.S. in terms of the way that it has treated Russia in terms of sanctions, in terms of just making it and a national security threat based on the way that the U.S. sees it. So is it a surprise that Russia has acted out the way that it did? Again, I need to make a note here that we are not for war. We're not advocating war by this question. But, you know, when you push somebody so much for such a length of time, then my question to you is it a surprise that Russia has acted out?
No, and I've written about this. I mean, first of all, I've been writing about this for years, that this was a risk, that eventually Russia probably would react the way they did because of, as you say, NATO expansion that really began in earnest under William Jefferson Clinton, even after numerous promises were made by James Baker and others that NATO would not move an inch east of Germany if the Berlin Wall came down, which it did, but the U.S. and NATO never upheld their part of that bargain. And you mentioned, of course, in 2014, the coup against the government in Ukraine, which the U.S. was behind, and the U.S.-backed ultra-right-wing forces that very quickly made it clear that they wanted to ethnically cleanse the ethnic Russian population from the eastern part of Ukraine. We see the New York Times in the past week has said what a lot of us have known for a while, that the CIA has been operating in Ukraine for some time, training and giving logistical support to armed forces that target Russians in Ukraine. So really what's happened in Madrid is simply an announcement of a position of a strategy that's existed for a long time, which has been the dismantling of Russia. I think that, you know, in the light of day now, as the years have passed, we can now honestly and truthfully say that the Cold War never really ended, that the Russians fully expected it would end with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the East Bloc in 1991. But for the West, it never ended, that was not enough, that it wasn't just about communism. It was about Russia as well, and it was about China as well. as potential adversaries. And now we know this, and now NATO is being very clear that their intention is to drive Russia into the ground.
Well, Kent Stone, when you take a look, I referred to a timeline there to Daniel Kovalik. When you take a look at the length of this war, the way that the U.S. has approached it in particular, and then you take a look at what has happened in this summit, where NATO felt that there needs to be a new rejuvenate this anti-Russia sentiment in a new form. It's almost like it's being reintroduced. Is there a possibility that they're doing that because they want to make sure that the threat or the perceived threat of Russia still exists among member states, led by the U.S., which is ramping up, in a sense, scaremongering, so that that remains and people or the countries don't falter from that course?
Well, it's clear to me and to people in the peace movement that what NATO is doing in Ukraine is to march NATO up to the borders of Russia, of the Russian Federation, and do to Russia what it did to the former Yugoslavia. That is to say, to defeat it militarily and then to dismember it, the better to gobble it up. It's part of the U.S. plan, with the help of its military alliance, NATO, to achieve hegemony over the entire world. After they supposedly get the defeat of Russia and the dismemberment of the Russian Federation, then they will move on to China. That's the plan. And it should be clear to everyone in the world. It's clear to us here in the peace movement, and it's clear to people who are demonstrating in Madrid today and having counter summits. And it's clear to the workers who are in Spain and Greece and other countries who are preventing supplies, military equipment for, of NATO going to Ukraine, that the NATO has, and the U.S., of course, has a warlike agenda. Their plans to expand their strike force, to label Russia as an adversary, and to label China as a threat is clearly antagonistic to our desire to have a peaceful world where all countries are their sovereignty is treated with respect. But that's not the case with NATO. When the U.S. decides that it wants to force a country to yield its energy resources, as in the case of Libya, or its strategic position in the case of Afghanistan, it unleashes NATO upon that country and creates havoc. It destroys whole countries and turns their population into refugees. And this is what we've seen over and over again in the past 30 years. And yes, the U.S. is trying to marshal its European vassals, and I say vassals because they can be herded, even though it's like herding cats. They can be herded and turned against an alleged enemy of the U.S. on the snap of its fingers, and they can even be persuaded to impose sanctions which cripple themselves rather than the supposed target. Right. There's going to be terrible results in Europe and North America as a result of the sanctions that have been leveled against Russia. And that's why we've been demonstrating this week all across Canada against NATO, demanding Canada get out of NATO, demanding that NATO disband, and that there should not be a new arms race, which is being provoked by NATO, by sending all these arms into Ukraine, and to insist on countries like Canada upping its military spending to 2%. In Canada, it means a 70% increase in military spending. It's outrageous.
Well, we're looking again at what the U.S. President Joe Biden has said, Daniel Kovalik, in terms of pledging more military aid, in terms of more, things like warplanes and warships for Europe. $5 billion in U.S. aid, or maybe a little more than that, has been pledged during the Biden administration. But at the same time, we're seeing that Russia is not losing the war. Russia is going ahead with what it's doing, especially in the Donbass region. And it's interesting how NATO nor the U.S. are really even stating that Ukraine is actually being defeated. Why then is the U.S. first, and then the NATO partner countries, sending more weapons and pledging more aid when Ukraine is being defeated? What does that say?
Well, we know why. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, about 6 weeks ago, I guess it was, made it very clear that the goal in Ukraine is to weaken Russia. That is to say, the U.S. will continue to support the war effort in Ukraine, regardless of whether Ukraine can win or not. They can't.
Well, tell us what you think he means when he says weaken Russia. You either weaken a country that's at war by either killing their soldiers or for that country to run out of ammunition. Which is it?
Well, I think they want to kill their soldiers. They want to continue to have U.S. or Russia send soldiers to Ukraine and be killed. And yes, they want them to use up weaponry. They want their government to spend their revenue, of course, some of which the U.S. has stolen, on weapons and soldiers instead of on the economy and building up the economy and putting money into social programs. This is exactly the strategy that the U.S. openly, or at least after the fact, admitted, Brzezinski admitted openly later, that they used against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. The goal in Afghanistan in the 80s was to draw the Soviet Union into a war that would undermine and destroy the Soviet Union. In the words of Brzezinski, he wanted to give the Soviet Union its Vietnam, referring, of course, to the U.S. war in Vietnam, which was very destructive of the United States. And that's exactly what happened. And it did, in fact, help to weaken and ultimately destroy the Soviet Union. This is exactly the same game plan. They wanted this war. They provoked this war. Even the Pope has said that probably this war was provoked by the U.S. and NATO. They wanted to do that. They wanted Russia to intervene. And they want to extend this war as long as possible to undermine and, if they could, destroy Russia. And they don't care about Ukraine or the Ukrainians. They will fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. That is what is very clear.
Well, let's see here. Let's refer Ken Stone to what the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has said. And let me get your reaction on this, on your reading into this. He said that Zelensky wanted to pretty much secure an advantageous position in this conflict with Russia in months. By the end of the year, it turned out was what Zelensky was referring to, rather than years. That's coming from the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan. What does that say when Jake Sullivan makes that statement, when he says in months is what Zelensky wants rather than years, which is what the U.S. has in mind?
Well, like our Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, the U.S. Leaders have made it clear that what they want to achieve in Ukraine, as Dan Kovalik has correctly pointed out, is to defeat Russia. And Chrystia Freeland used the words vanquish Russia and defeat it. She said that while she was donating $500 million of Canadians' taxpayers' money to Ukraine. And in addition to that, they've sent several billion dollars worth of military equipment and other kinds of funding to Ukraine. And the purpose of this is to bring about the defeat of Russia. It's the opposite. It shows that the U.S. and NATO, Canada, and all the other NATO allies have an aggressive agenda here, and they're not about to look for peace with Russia. They've encouraged Mr. Zelensky and his government to continue fighting rather than bring about de-escalation, rather than fueling the conflict with arms and arms and funding. And now Canadian special forces, according to the New York Times, are in Ukraine. And we were at the minister's office in Oakville yesterday, the defense minister's office, and she doesn't deny the fact that they're there. So they're there. And so Canada is de facto at war with Russia right now because we have boots on the ground in Ukraine. It's an aggressive war. What the opposite of all this would be, as the Russians argue, there should be a mutual security system in Europe such that no, the security of one state doesn't impinge upon the security of others. If all the states got together and achieved a collective or a mutual security system, we could have peace. But that's not on the agenda for the U.S. and NATO. This is clearly an aggressive move, an escalation, which brings us closer to the unthinkable, as your earlier report said. It brings us closer to a nuclear confrontation between nuclear powers. And that's something that could bring about the end, that would bring about the end of human civilization. So we should think, people across the world are thinking about the danger of this. And that's why people are in the streets, because they don't want this U.S. aggressive action in Ukraine and in Madrid to strengthen NATO to bring about the end of their lives and their children's lives.
Indeed. Well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Daniel Kovala, Kent Stone talks about this unified security apparatus of some kind to be agreed upon, as Russia has proposed, so that, there could be a mutual approach towards this conflict. But when you have Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, talk about how this war is going to end on the negotiating table, and at the same breath, he says, only on the condition that Ukraine gets what it wants. I repeat, Ukraine gets what it wants. And that depends on the gains on the battlefield. How can you have a unified strategy of security when the other side is talking about what I just said?
This has never been about security. Not national security, not the security of the EU. Russia's never been a threat to the EU or to the United States. In fact, we have to be reminded that Putin was the first world leader to call George W. Bush after 9/11. Offer condolences, offer help in the war on terror. Russia always wanted to work with the West. This is not about security. This is about the West's desire to create insecurity in Russia, to destroy Russia. That's what this is about. This has nothing to do with the EU protecting its own security. In fact, just the opposite. The sanctions have backfired on the EU. They are making the EU more insecure. They're going to be lucky if they can heat their homes come this winter.
Exactly. I'm going to have to jump in, unfortunately. Daniel Kovalik, we're just fresh out of time. I'm so sorry. Daniel Kovalik, the international human rights and labor lawyer. Thank you, from Pittsburgh, PA. Kent Stone, Canada out of NATO. I see your pin. We got the message. Thank you. Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tahwe. And the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al Musavi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 for Al-Imam Ali ibn Hussein Zain al-Abidin, found in As-Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah. We go to the part where Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from shakasat al-akhlaq, bad morals and bad ethics. Now, we have to understand and keep in mind that bad morals and bad ethics, it hurts people more than anything. And those who have bad morals and bad ethics are the most hated people in society. Opposite to that are those who have good akhlaq and good morals. Those are loved by everybody around them. It came to the point that the Quran and the words of the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam, they linked good morals and good akhlaq to iman, and bad akhlaq and bad morals to lack of iman, lack of faith, lack of belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because if a person has a belief in Allah, and that is strong, not just saying, yes, I am a muwahid, I'm a monotheist, I do submit to Allah, that's one thing. As-shahada, to witness that there is no one, no God but Allah, is one thing. To act upon it is another. You can see that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, he says in a hadith, مَا يُوضَعُ فِي الْمِيزَانِ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ مَا يُوضَعُ فِي مِيزَانِ إِمْرَئٍ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ أَفْضَلُ مِنْ حُسْنِ الْخُلُقِ. Let us take a short break, and then we will get back to this hadith.
رَبَّنَا
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Before the break, we ended up with the hadith where the Prophet says, "Ma yudha fi mizan imri'in." There's nothing that can be put on the scales of a person on a day of judgment, afdalu min husnil khuluq, better, heavier than good morals.